Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Ruler podcast. I'm Ian Parkinson. It's been a while. This is the podcast for issue 65, and I hope by now you'll have had the chance to read it from cover to cover. One of the highlights for me is the first-person diary from his very first Tour de France by the Orica bike exchange rider, Chris Juliensen, and I'm delighted to say he's on the line now. Chris, welcome to the Ruler podcast.
Thank you very much.
Where are you exactly?
I'm in Denmark. I'm in Copenhagen. I've just come home from Eneco Tour, actually.
Yeah, how was that? Parts of it looked like a Flanders Classic this year.
Yeah, it was a good race, and it got pretty grim on the Sunday stage, but I enjoyed it. With my sort of Irish Nordic blood, I have nothing against riding in the rain. So I had a good time in Eneco, and now I'm getting ready for the team time trial worlds. So I'm riding around Copenhagen, looking like a triathlete on my TT bike. It's a bit worrying.
I'm trying to decipher your accent because it's a fascinating accent. Now, you're Danish, you ride for an Australian team, but you were actually brought up in Ireland. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, both my parents are Danish. So there's no Irish family back in Ireland. But yeah, my older brother, younger sister and I, we were born and raised in Ireland, lived there for 16 years and went to Denmark in 2005.
So how did you get into cycling then?
Mainly because my dad, he picked it up, not because he's a former bike rider, he started at a late age. And then my brother got interested, and it was mountain, we rode mountain bike primarily back then. And typical little brother, I thought, okay, my brother can, then I certainly can as well. And then it sort of more or less just took off from there. And then it was more or less... because of foot and mouth disease, which most people probably can remember, that we were forced onto the road. We were never really keen road riders, but because we couldn't really ride or race for an entire year in the forest or on the fields, then we took up road racing, and I quickly preferred that to mountain biking.
Well, let's take a look at your tour diary in issue 65, because it's a lovely piece of writing. What prompted you to do it?
Well, I enjoyed doing the piece when I did my first Giro for the magazine. Although it was still sort of a diary, but it's slightly different in the way I collected all my thoughts or my experiences through doing my first Grand Tour. And I've enjoyed quite a lot writing the blogs for the magazine. But I thought this time, it being the tour, but also I've just changed in terms of what's interested me writing wise, not to sound like I'm an established writer, but I felt that it would be interesting to try and write something slightly more, write more thorough account of my tour experience compared to the Giro, which was on postcards, cycling gloves, feed bags, cake wrappers. It was slightly more, had maybe a more funny tone to it, where the tour experience has a slightly more serious tone to it.
You say during the piece that you're a little bit fed up with social media. You're kind of fed up with the fast stuff, as it were.
Yeah.
Was that part of it as well?
It was, in a way, because I think it's important for me to make people clear the fact that I'm nothing against social media or people who use it. I was just getting, if they use it, or not, there's no way of use social media correctly. But personally, it's becoming too much, if you ask me. I'm not good at taking pictures, so it would be a bit of a lie if I was to make an Instagram account and be like, oh, look, I can Photoshop 15 times a picture. Now I'm suddenly a photographer. Twitter was always a bit of fun, but it started, you know, taking up too much time. You know, it was time waste from my perspective. So I was like, I might as well try and delete that side of time waste and, you know, ignore all the noise that comes from Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. If I'm not really using it to any sort of beneficial purpose, then I enjoyed more actually sort of ignoring it and then concentrating on gathering my own account without having to necessarily tell the whole world about it. But then the ironic thing is people could say, yeah, but okay, you posted it in one of the coolest magazines. So aren't you also guilty of wanting people to know and hear and listen about what I am, what I experience? But I still feel it's slightly different because I think it's healthy, certainly for me, to not constantly walk around with that, you know, that urge that, oh, this is a cool moment, or this is enjoyable, or this is whatever. You can be from having a dinner with your missus or going for a walk, going for a cycle, but not necessarily having that urge that you have to share it with everyone, because at the end of the day, no one really cares. What really matters is that you remember the bloody experience and you take it all in. So that was something that I enjoyed with writing the diary. You know, it was sit down, write something, or write a lot, or write not very much, but still just, you know, keep it to myself and then afterwards give it to you guys and then see what people think of it.
So when you were writing stuff down, was it with an eye to publication? Was it sort of in the back of your head, someone else is going to read this? Or was it very much a sort of private diary when you were writing it?
It was, obviously I knew that I was, you know, I wanted people to read about my tour experience which is one of the reasons why I like writing for the Roller, is that although I'm a bike rider, I like trying to explain and describe to people the different aspects of being a bike rider, not necessarily of getting on your bike, riding 200 plus kilometers, but more about all the other stuff that, you know, revolves around riding a bike, being a pro, doing the world's biggest bike race. So obviously when I wrote all this down, it was, I knew that I'd send it into you guys. So you could call it a diary, but yeah, it's more just an account of how I experienced the tour. Because as you notice, there's a lot of the time where I actually don't mention what happens in the stage or in the race, and which, you know, would for many people also be interesting, considering we won a stage. Yatesy was fourth, didn't come out of nowhere, but still fourth, won the white jersey, where I preferred sort of more explaining about my own sort of account, my own experience, and this whole circus of riding the Tour de France for the first time.
And did you find it helped writing things down by hand as well on paper?
Yeah, I've never been particularly good at writing things down on computer when it's sort of, for example, when I write my when I used to write the blogs, I'd always jot down all my ideas on paper first and then sort of collect my ideas on the computer. I think that has something to do with the way we'd study, or we'd go to school in Ireland, St. Andrew's College, and then also how I studied in Denmark. It was always written in hand. So I've never been particularly good at, you know, it's more honest when it's in hand, you know what I mean? And then it was quite nice because I said, you know, I'd be lying in my bed. I'm like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? Because you're wrecked. I was wrecked after the stages and just exhausted. And you know, that's why obviously having the internet, it's a nice thing to have, because you can sort of channel your exhaustion through that, where it's different reading and writing when you're tired. But it was still a nice thing to do, because I was sort of forced to do it, or read something or write something, regardless of how interesting or non-interesting it is, because I chose to not go on Facebook and not go on Twitter. And it's not to sound like one of these anti-social or anti-social media hippies, like, ooh, it's poisonous and blah, blah, blah. I just felt it was a relief to be sort of, you know, ignorant of what's going on. Just concentrate on what you're actually doing in real life. Because then all of a sudden, you know, the world is not so big, you know, and overwhelming. But then, you know, all this shit in Nice happened, which was, you know, you couldn't avoid it.
That was the terrorist attack on Bastille Day.
Yeah. And there, that I found out by hearing the I listened to the Danish radio, so I listened to the news, and I read the newspapers, so I knew all about it, and I was still addicted to that news, you know, that channel of news and breaking news. So, in a way, I was, you know, I fell back into this ocean of information that you can sort of discuss: is it necessary? Is it not? Because it created this uneasiness, which it often does when you hear about these horrible tragedies. And there it was quite nice to be able to sort of write about it, because you're walking around with all these thoughts and these worries and these insecurities, and no one's really talking about it, because it was not a taboo, but it was like, okay, we're doing the race. And then the tragedy in Nice happens, like, you can't ignore it. You know, you can't ignore the impact it has on both France, the rest of the world, and then the race, which is taking place in France, not particularly far from Nice. And we're just, you know, this thought of, you know, none of the riders, we really wanted to accept that, bloody hell, we're sitting ducks, you know, we're potential targets. And they were sort of nice to get it off my chest and write about it, because at the end of the day, it was something that took up quite a lot of space. But I was just glad I came to the conclusion that the feeling of being able to, you know, give something back, in terms of the amount of people that were along the side of the road, whether it was before or after the Nice tragedy, they were still going to see a bike race that passed, and it took 5 seconds, and the bike riders, they were out of sight. But we were part of this summer, you know, enjoyment. This people relate Tour de France with summer, and summer with Tour de France. And that was nice to feel that being a part of something that, you know, encourage people to go outside and enjoy a bit of sunshine, have a bit of wine, and not concentrate so much on all the negative stuff going around.
You talk a lot about sort of wanting to describe what it's like being a pro rider, not just on the bike, but the whole, everything that surrounds it. Is there anyone that you've read who thinks gets it right? Are there any sort of people you've come across that where you thought, yeah, that they get it?
Well, that's a good question. And here I might expose myself of being a bit of a novice in terms of reading other people's stuff. or maybe being just too vain that I only read my own stuff and ignore everybody else's.
Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that you're not influenced by other people.
Yeah, yes and no. I think where I've been influenced is, for example, the books I've been reading. They're, you know, some of these modern classics and these classics. It's sort of like when you watch an old film. If you watch The Deer Hunter, and then you watch a similar movie but made in, you know, being produced now, the scenes are so much longer in the old movies. You know, things are being described. It takes a lot more time to sort of describe the atmosphere, the pictures. Everything's sort of dragged out, where nowadays, which maybe reflects our sort of our need to know everything fast and easy and quick, it's sort of, things are sort of shortened. And it's the same with these books I read, and it's interesting to read them. And the books are relatively simple. You know, the storyline's pretty simple, pretty basic, but it's just the way the author is able to describe all the elements involved with the story, you know, just walking down the street, or, you know, how the all sort of basic, general, everyday things that you notice without really noticing it, how that's put into words. And that's, you know, and it's hard to find examples, because you read heaps, and then it's like when someone asks you, what's your favorite song? You're like, oh, shit, I can't even remember what my favorite band is, you know? But it's more, that's how I sort of wished to try and describe my experience with cycling, if that makes any sense.
You describe your reading list for the tour, which includes some George Orwell and some Ernest Hemingway. And that's sort of not the typical reading matter, I imagine. Maybe I'm being unfair, for a pro cyclist.
Yes and no. I think there's more readers than people may think. But again, it was maybe an unusual reading list. But I brought those books mainly because I'd asked people that I know through cycling primarily. You know, cycling's quite interesting. You get to know so many different people through so many different layers, social layers, you know, artists, authors, journalists, business, you know, influential people within, you know, who have, you know, powerful business jobs. So they're all able to influence me in terms of what they think I should read. So I like asking all these people. And then I brought the books, and then I found them, you know, quite fascinating in terms of how they're written and how, you know, it could be cool to try not and write something as good or similar, because I believe I'm far from it. But still trying to, you know, give an account of cycling, which is maybe your not your typical account, because the typical account is stage whatever, got my bike, my legs were tired, I had my big breakfast but didn't really want to. The stage started, talked to a few guys, had to get some bottles. We hit a climb. It's so hard climb. I did such and such watch, blah, 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 blah. And it's like everyone can see that in the telly. You know, you can see those accounts on the television. But you can't really see or feel or smell or hear what it's like being within the bunch or thinking about not being in the race when all you've done for the whole year is be at the race. And then the moment you get in the bike, you're fantasizing or daydreaming about, you know, spending your holiday along the road in some, you know, beautiful area in France. You know, these strange thoughts and feelings that go through your body at the same time you're doing the world's biggest bike race and you're expected to perform and all you want to do is perform, you know? If that makes any sense, it could, my way of explaining it could be a bit mumbo jumbo.
It makes perfect sense. And of course, Ernest Hemingway, you took The Movable Feast, and Hemingway loved cycling. And there's actually a bit of a touch of Hemingway in some of the writing that you've done. It's those very short sentences, the very direct language. Was that a deliberate thing? Had you read Hemingway before you started doing the diary?
No, but I do enjoy trying to explain as much in as, you know, as few sentences, as short a sentence as possible, because at the end of the day, I'm also a bike rider, so I like things being simple and easy to understand. And what I've trying to learn through, also through reading some of these books, is that you can explain a lot without having to write too much, you know? It's a question, like with my blogs, they have to be easy to read, easy to understand, but they have to be filled with examples and, you know, pictures that people can paint in their own heads, but it doesn't have to be a paragraph where there's maybe two sentences, you know, it has to be digestible. And that's why I find that these books that people call modern classics, it's quite interesting to see how easy they've been written, but how well they've been written, if you know what I mean. Like there's heaps of, you know, you paint so many cool pictures in your head when reading them, and you know, you start thinking and this and that, but it's they're quite easily read. But they're still, you know, but and then they're being regarded as these influential classic books that everyone should read.
George Orwell, in particular, sort of an example of someone who wrote very simply, but incredibly powerfully.
Yeah.
Have you read Bill Strickland's 10 Points? Has anyone recommended that to you?
No.
Bill Strickland of Bicycling Magazine wrote a book called 10 Points, which is not really about being a pro, because he was an amateur rider, and actually it's about much, much more than bike racing. But you should take a look at that if you've got some spare time. Some of the best descriptions, I think, of riding in a bunch and that confusion, the sort of madness of being in a race.
Yeah, I think I'd enjoy that, because I think there's, like you said, there's heaps of people, riders, not just me, who look at cycling the same way as I do. And then again, you know, I'm as guilty as everybody else on social media. It's like, the people there could be more writers out there who are better, more knowledgeable and better at explaining than I am, that maybe listening to this podcast and like, fuck, nah. he likes the sound of his own voice, you know. If he was an ice cream, he'd lick himself. So it is this fine line of being, not being too much sort of out there and be like, oh, look at me, I read this in this book and I wrote this in this blog. But at the end of the day, that's what I enjoy, and that also, it sort of reflects my personality, that I like telling people about what I'm interested in. I just don't feel necessary to sort of bombard people, you know, oh, I'm having lunch, look at this picture of me having lunch. Like, if lunch is so great, don't take a picture of it. Maybe enjoy lunch with your friends or your missus instead of trying to tell people about it.
So this year was not only your first Tour de France, it was also your first experience of the Gruppetto in the Tour de France, the autobus. How was that for you? How was that experience?
It was good, but again, like I gave an account of sort of a Gruppetto experience, which is this sort of uncomfortable nerviness, you know, that I always experience when I'm in the Gruppetto, when I'm not sure whether we're in or out of the time limit. And I've never actually been in a Gruppetto where we've gone out of the time limit. It's hard to say it's enjoyable, but it's always enjoyable when you're there on the basis of having done a big load of work, you know. The Gruppetto more or less every day in the Giro last year where Alberto won, that was actually quite enjoyable because I was one of the reasons why the Gruppetto had been formed, why people were tired, because I'd been sitting at the front most of the day for a lot of the stages. Where the Tour was sort of a little bit different, but still the same. You know, you work hard, you get dropped, and then you have to go on the Gruppetto. But there's always this sort of transition between getting dropped to falling into the Gruppetto that I've always found a little bit difficult, you know? And you can see that some riders, they just can't accept that now they're dropped. Now, the most clever thing to do and reasonable thing to do is get into the Gruppetto, make sure that you're fine at a time limit, and then save as much energy as possible. But you see heaps of riders who sort of, a bit like me as well. I can imagine my dad would be one of these riders who just would not accept defeat. And it's also unfair to call it defeat because it's just, you've done your work. You can't, you know, you get dropped. People are just faster and stronger. Now you have to, you know, use your brain a little bit because you still have maybe 14, 15, 17 stages left. And it's a question of saving as much energy as possible. And then it's like, but maybe, and ooh, and I could maybe find another group. But looking back, I should have said, okay, fine, Gruppetto for me every day where I got dropped, you know. And then there's some stages where you can go, okay, now I can keep going for as long as possible and maybe try a little bit longer when I'm not with the front guys. But, you know, it has to be done in a manageable way so you have enough energy for the next day so you can do your work. It makes no sense spending a shitload of energy for on yourself in no man's land. And then you go next stage and you're like, oh, lads, I'm a bit tired because I was, oh, what were you doing? Oh, I wasn't, were you in the Gruppetto? No. Were you in the front group? No. Where were you then? Oh, I finished like 50th. Oh, that's great. What team can use that?
Thank you for joining us on the podcast. Are you planning to carry on with the writing?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, again, which is why I enjoyed doing the tour, because sometimes I could not get stressed, but this feeling of, I want to write a blog, you know, I want to try and explain or tell a story or whatever. And the more I wrote about, obviously the less ideas I sort of had left. And then, you know, sometimes someone would just shoot into mind, like for example, one of my, the latest blogs, which was in the spring or in the winter, I can't remember, where I wrote about a doping test, which is like, obviously this is something people never experience. So, and it, you know, there's so many awkward situations that occur during a doping test. And people are maybe afraid of sort of talking, ooh, I've been doping test. Like there's maybe this taboo about talking about an actual test, you know, it's completely harmless. So I was like, oh, obviously there's a lot to talk about here. But now throughout this season, I felt that the tour was a great opportunity to actually write something in depth and then not have to worry so much about the blogs, you know, having to do blogs continuously throughout the year. Sort of do something, do a chunk, and it's cool that it's in print as well. And then I'll just have to, you know, see what comes up, you know, in the course of the next couple of months. You know, maybe something all of a sudden I'll be like, oh, obviously I'll write about that. But now I go to the World TT, you know, the Triple T, the team time trial. And there's so much involved with that, but I've already wrote about it. I wrote about that 2 years ago, you know. So I have to sort of find new ideas where I feel it necessary to, you know, give my sort of side of the story, my experience of something.
And maybe a book when you eventually retire.
Yeah, maybe. But I'm always a little bit very careful with the whole book thing because, first of all, if it was to be a book, which is maybe also one of the things I enjoyed with the writing with the tour thing because it was sort of somewhat longer than my blogs. So in a way, I wouldn't call it a book, but it was a mini book for me anyway. But I was to write a book, I would most definitely write it myself. You know, I wouldn't want a ghostwriter to do it. So, and I can't write it in the style of my blog. You know, I remember I read a book called A Year in the Merde about an English journalist who went to Paris and spent a year in France. And it was super funny. But after 200 pages, you know, it's not really funny anymore. So if I wrote a book that was sort of in the same tone as my blogs, I think myself and everyone else included would be like, okay, it was funnier when it was a couple of paragraphs, but when it's an entire book, it's sort of like steady on. So if I were ever to write a book, I certainly have to be slightly more mature in my writing style, I feel. But luckily, you know, I'm only a 50-year pro, so I have a lot to experience yet before I can sort of defend my reasoning for writing a book.
Thanks so much for joining us. Do stay around just for a little while. I hope you do have many years riding ahead of you, and I hope you carry on writing as well. All that remains for me to do on this podcast is the Rouleau competition. On the last podcast, David Miller asked how many times has Nairo Quintana ridden the Tour de France? And the answer was, at the time of asking, of course, twice. The prizes were 3 signed copies of Chris Boardman's book, Triumphs and Turbulence, and the winners are Martin Wallace, Michael Brunskill and James Mussett. Now, for this podcast, the question was going to be, where was Chris Juliensen born? However, you've kind of given that away earlier on in the podcast. Can you think of another question that that you could ask our listeners?
We could ask what club did I ride for when I was an underage rider, but I don't know, that would be a slightly too specific question.
Let's make it hard for them, because the prize is really good. The prize is actually a road book, the Bible, from this year's Tour de France, from the Tour de France 2016. So let's make it hard. So which club did you ride for as a junior?
Not as a junior, but as a under 16 rider before I moved to Denmark. So my club in Ireland.
So which club did you ride for in Ireland as an under 16 rider?
And if you need a bonus question, you can ask people, who did I ride the Youth Olympics for in 2005, for Ireland or for Denmark?
Okay, that will be a tiebreaker, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so go to the podcast page of the Rouleau website, look at podcast 65, all the instructions for the competition are there. The Rouleau Classic is coming soon in London. Hope you've got your tickets already. Lots of star names there. Hopefully no repeat of Kenny Van Flamick's behaviour of last year. Listen out for that. Take it easy out there, and thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.